speaker and let them expand on the point that they have. We have 45 minutes. Once again, we have two microphones, and a microphone will be held by two moderators that will go around to individuals who raise their hands to ask questions. So if you have a question, raise your hand, and we begin by having questions. And the microphone would stay in the hand of the moderator for purposes known to all of us.
The poster for this event talked about the rights and wrongs of occupation. You haven't discussed what was right, so I want to mention a few things and then have you comment on them. When Israel acquired the territories in 1967, the life expectancy of men was 48 years. By 2000, the life expectancy was 72. Under Israel's brutal and genocidal occupation, infant mortality decreased from 60 deaths per thousand births to 15 deaths per thousand births. Childhood illnesses, tetanus, diphtheria, mumps, measles were wiped out because the first thing Israel did in the territories was vaccinate the children. When Israel acquired these territories, there were no institutions of higher learning. Israel built 7. Israel built 177 medical clinics. Israel built a soccer stadium and a sewage treatment plant. Okay, my question is, one thing you haven't talked about was the what Israel did right during obligation, and I'd like for you to discuss why you think that during the 1970s, the Palestinian territories had the fourth fastest growing economy in the world.
You understand that in terms of international law, Israel as the occupying power is obliged in law to advance the well-being and welfare of the occupied people. I accept that Israel, just in the early years, complied with some of its obligations, but in the last 7 or 8 years since the Second Intifada, Israel has seriously neglected its responsibilities. It has been responsible for causing humanitarian crisis. It has been responsible for undermining the medical welfare of the Palestinian people. One only has to look at the situation in Gaza, where the Israeli authorities do not allow Palestinians to leave Gaza to go to Israeli hospitals. This is all documented by an Israeli human rights body called Position for Human Rights.
Yet the amount of Gazans
we've been Can we let the speaker?
Has increased by 45%
in the last year. Could I just say something? I haven't discussed the question of South African apartheid in Israel, but I just wanted to just say that I live in South Africa during the apartheid period, and I witnessed the discrimination applied by the South African government. But the South African government did more for the material welfare of the South African population in terms of hospitals, health care, education, schools, universities, than Israel has done for the Palestinian people. Israel is in serious violation of its obligations under the Fourth Geneva Convention to advance the welfare of the Palestinian people. This is so abundantly clear, particularly in the case of Gaza, where
Israel is no longer occupying Gaza.
What is the UN doing to release
Khalid Shalit? On this situation, I would like to see Khalid released, but I would also like to see 11,000 Palestinians from the one more thing on the subject of Gaza. the peaceful military occupation is effective control. The question is Israel truly effective control of Gaza following the withdrawal of settlers and permanent IDF presence from Gaza in 2005? Israel still controls the crossings. Israel still controls the airspace of Gaza. I'm talking about Gaza airspace and Gaza sea space. Israel maintains a register of people in Gaza and will not allow people in and out of Gaza. Israel carefully manipulates the supply of food and fuel to the territory. It carries out solid booms over Gaza. It has effective control over Gaza. The whole international community, with the exception of Israel and the United States, accepts that Israel is the military, is in military occupation of Gaza. The International Committee of the Red Cross, which monitors the Fourth Geneva Convention, accepts this.
Can we get another question?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
Yay.
It's okay, just everybody just take a breathe. This is just normal. Just think this is unusual. Let's compare it to a Palestinian in the Gaza Strip attempting to cross the border. They sometimes have to wait 3 months just to go across. We could take a few minutes to listen. And tomorrow they have an entertainment session in here that is pro-Israel that people could listen to if they choose to. But now let's have some enlightened discussion.
The legal and moral question is clear. However, that leads to a question of raw political and military power. How can we as U.S. citizens counter the Zionist subversion in our body politic?
I think the most effective way to try to achieve a just and lasting peace in the conflict is to free ourselves of all rhetoric, free ourselves of all demagogy, and just stick hard and fast to the elementary facts. People are perfectly capable of grasping facts, reasoned argument, documented information. And I'm not nearly as pessimistic as you, but we have to be, I think, two things. We have to make a maximum effort to be reasonable. And secondly, we have to make a maximum effort not to engage in rhetoric or demagogy, such as Zionist subversion. I just don't think that's particularly useful. What's useful, in my opinion, is to do exactly, if I may be faulted for praising him again, to do exactly what Professor Dugard just did. Everybody knows Corporal Shalit's name, but how many of you, and I include myself, know the names of one, just one, of the 11,000 Palestinians being held by Israel? If you read the wretched and disgusting report that was put out recently by the Europeans, they go to the issue of the administrative detention of the and the treatment of the Palestinians under detention. And then what does it do? It begins by saying, or I should say in its recommendations, it begins by saying, first of all, let's praise Israel for releasing 149 of the prisoners. 149 of 11,000. And you can be certain after it releases 149, next week it'll arrest 300. And then secondly it says, we have to release Corporal Shalit. Now, that's wretched. That's so grossly hypocritical. And I think, with a certain amount of common sense and dignity and intelligence, to recite the facts, Professor Dugard mentioned the ICRC said Gaza is still under occupation. Even Human Rights Watch, if you look at its reports right after the so-called withdrawal from Gaza, Human Rights Watch wrote in its annual report, Gaza remains under effective Israeli control and occupation. There was no dispute in the international community. What happened in Gaza? The settlers left, the Israeli army redeployed on the periphery of Gaza. It threw the keys of the jail to the inmates. They got out of the jail, true, their jails, but then Israel withdrew to the periphery, slammed the doors of the prison shut, and then said, you're free. We have no more obligation to you. That wasn't serious. Everybody understood it at the time. In March of that year, Beth Sullivan put out a report entitled One Big Prison to describe what was going on in Gaza. Those are the facts. Let's say everything the previous questioner said was true, that the conditions have improved, they're better than they were before. Well, I'm old enough, regrettably, to remember during the Civil Rights Movement. That was exactly what was said about blacks and their second-class citizenship. Aren't they doing better than black people in Africa? That was the argument that was standardly used. You list all those wonderful statistics, some of which are flat out false. Israel did not build any institutions of higher education in the occupied territories. Those were built with Arab money. Israel did not build Birzeit, it did not build any of the Arab institutions. Higher education in the occupied territories. But then you left out in that beautiful record of that liberal and enlightened occupation. You left out so much. You left out that Israel was the only country in the world which legalized torture. You left out that Israel was the only country in the world which legalized house demolition as a form of punishment. You left out that Israel was the only country in the world which legalized hostage taking, or as the Chief Justice of the court called it, taking the bargaining chips. You left out that between 1987 and 1993, Israel, by conservative estimates, tortured about 20,000 to 30,000 Palestinian detainees. A very beautiful record. I wonder why you omitted those facts.
Is considering international laws and ability to extend human rights to the Palestinians. I ask, how effective is the framework of international law? And in using South Africa as a model, what was the effect of international law in comparison to the uprising of the South Africans?
It's interesting to compare the response of the international community to apartheid with the response of the international community to Palestine. You want to call that in the early years of apartheid, the apartheid regime was to some extent protected by the Western powers, Britain, France, and the United States, passed their vetoes in the Security Council to prevent action from being taken against South Africa in order to abolish discrimination in South Africa. But everything changed over the years. The West realized that apartheid in South Africa had become the litmus test for human rights in the international community, and that it did not take a firm stand against South Africa, that the credibility of the West would suffer. And so we see a movement in the United Nations in the other direction against the apartheid regime, and ultimately the United Nations was able to adopt resolutions imposing economic sanctions or arms embargo on South Africa. The United States went so far 1986 was to impose economic sanctions on South Africa. Civil society was outraged. The whole world was outraged. Now compare that with what is happening in Palestine. I don't wish to say that Israel practices apartheid in the occupied territory. It is a military occupier. It is not engaged in institutionalized race discrimination and terrorism. But there are resemblances between the two systems. I won't go into them in detail, but any South African, back to life, who lived through the apartheid years and who has visited the West Bank in Gaza can only be struck by the similarities. And I would go so far as Richard Tutu and others have said, to say that the situation in occupied Palestine is worse than it was in the apartheid South Africa. So why has there been so little response on the part of the international community? Well, as I indicated, the developing world is seriously distressed by what is happening in the occupied Palestinian territory, and it calls upon the West to honor its commitment to human rights. But the West fails to respond. I don't have to give the reasons for this. The United States has a large pro-Israeli lobby, both in the Jewish community and in the evangelical community. So Israel is very prominent in the foreign policy of the United States, and Israel, the United States is determined to protect Israel. But the same applies to the European Union. The European Union, I think, consists of many states that did not behave well, to put it kindly, during the Second World War. And they have a Holocaust guilt. And I think this leads them to treat Israel very kindly as well. So the result is that we find that the West, the United States and the European Union, are not prepared to take firm action against Israel. The European Union is more troubled than the United States, and it does provide material welfare to the Palestinian people, but it doesn't go so far as to take firm action against Israel. It doesn't even attempt to enforce the advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice. So I think, I suppose, the moral of the story is that it may take time for the West to realize that the way in which human rights are violated in the occupied Palestinian territory is the litmus test for human rights in the world
today. First of all, you should know, Professor Degard, that America's so-called leading leftist intellectual Noam Chomsky virtually denies the existence of the Israel lobby. I just want to say the criticism of the KKK, or as we saw here, the Zionist KKK, that white liberals were race traitors did not stop Martin Luther King from criticizing white liberals from the left, as he did in his letter from Birmingham jail. A quick statement, a quick question. I was part of the anti-apartheid movement in the United States, and I want to say that that it wasn't a purely advisory, non-binding, non-enforceable, ignorable, even by the UN Secretary General and International Court of Justice opinions that compelled the end of South African apartheid. It was practical resistance, including boycotts, economic and cultural boycotts, international divestment movement, the practical consciousness-raising value of those, and ultimately international sanctions. Opposed by Noam Chomsky and called problematic by Mr. Finkelstein, they compelled the end of South African apartheid. My question that I have is actually from an Arab American friend of mine who lives in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and heard Mr. Finkelstein's lecture a couple of weeks ago in Michigan. And her question, which she desperately wanted me to answer, was Mr. Finkelstein now says that Palestinians and their supporters should even talk about Zionism, calling that, quote, a Starbucks discussion, unquote, which I consider not only dismissive, but ridiculing.
Done. What was the question?
Okay. Would Nazi, neo-Nazi, pro-Jim Crow, pro-apartheid, and other white supremacist solidarity activists, or even white liberals, have had or had the right to tell Jews or blacks not to condemn
Done. The rape? We're 15 seconds over time, so you owe us money for that.
Yeah.
And your response?
Here's the second part. The ideology of white supremacy.
Oh, she said I
should
wrap it up.
She said I should
wrap it up.
I'll give you one sentence. Wrap it up.
It's a half a sentence.
The ideology of white supremacy and Nazism, slavery, Jim Crowism, segregation, and apartheid, based on his visit and voice interview.
That's not one sentence.
That's true.
Yeah, response.
I guess the obvious response is, do you want to talk to yourself or do you want to talk to the rest of the world? If you want to talk to yourself, you can use any slogan you want. And if you're serious about trying to enlighten people and get people to act on the basis of reason and facts, and you try to use a language which people, in their ordinary conversation or on the basis of their own ordinary moral intuitions, will understand. When I was a young man, I dismissed everybody who I didn't agree with as a fascist pig. Well, I don't think that converted, and then it made me feel great. But I don't think it converted many people. And frankly, I don't think that sort of language should convert people. Because we're not talking about revelation, and we're not talking about sudden conversions. We want people to act on the basis of reason and facts and logic and good, solid moral judgment. And it's just not very useful if you want to get people to act on the basis of that and not stir them up in some sort of demagogy. It's not useful to use slogans. And that comes from somebody who, for a large part of his life, used slogans.
Do we have a question in the back?
Oh, Mr. Finkelstein, I had a lot of questions about the omissions from your lecture. At the 1967 war, you omitted any discussion of the Arab League rejecting any peace negotiation or recognition of Israel, and rejecting the acceptance of territory and take. You also omitted to mention that Israel is withdrawn from more territory, that would be the Sinai and Gaza, than it has retained. You also omitted the current government of Israel, the Kadima Party, was elected on the basis of withdrawing from the occupied territories, withdrawing some to reaching peace, and there's no one to accept it. And your whole point seems to be premised on the argument that the 1949 armistice line is some sort of border. Is, in your opinion, legally, was that armistice line magically transformed into an internationally recognized border?
Okay. Let's just quickly go through the record. I don't have time now to go through the record on the diplomatic record between 1967 and the present. It would take us very far afield, so I assure you I can cite the facts in a convincing way. Just for the sake of this evening, look at the recent record. The Arab League in 2002, every member of the Arab League, every single member, agreed to recognize Israel on the June 1967 war and the basis of what it called a just settlement of the refugee question. The Arab League again in 2007 reiterated its position in 2002. That is, every single member of the Arab League joined the international consensus in supporting a two-state settlement on the June 67 border. The only outlier is Israel. On the question of withdrawal, he said Israel has withdrawn from more territory that it's kept. Fair enough. But you have to remember what international law is, those fundamentals. It didn't say the admissibility of acquiring some territory by war. It said the inadmissibility of acquiring territory by war, any territory by war. Under international law, Israel is obliged to fully withdraw from the territories it acquired in June 1967. There's no ambiguity on that question. Now you say, why should we accept that 1949 armistice line as the border? Well, there are two possible answers to that. Number one, as trying to stress, I'm not giving you my opinion. Your quarrel is not with me. Your quarrel is with those 161 nations and the United Nations General Assembly, which said Israel has to withdraw from the June 1967 border. Your quarrel is with the International Court of Justice, which said the June 1967 border is Israel's border. But let's, for the sake of argument, agree. You're correct. The 1949 border is just an armistice border. Let's agree with that. Okay. Well, then why can't the Arab states say, let's return to the partition resolution? Let's return to 56% of Palestine for the Jews and 44% for the Palestinian Arabs. If you now say the 49 border is just an armistice line and it's not the border, then it seems to me equally credible and plausible to say that Israel has to withdraw further than the armistice line. It has to withdraw to the 181 resolution and go back to 56% of Palestine. Do you accept that?
I would rather see the 1923 borders.
Well, two-thirds listen, I'm sure you'd rather see Judea and Samaria from 20 B.C. Fortunately, you're not making the law.
Yeah.
My first point was thank you so much for informing us of your knowledge, and my second point was I was wondering what you guys think of the statement the President of the Islamic Republic of Iran said, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, of what should be done to Israel. I really wanted to know what you guys think of that.
Well, first of all, with all due respect, and I hope I'm not sounding pompous here, but I don't appreciate referring to us as you guys. For your age, you should learn a little bit of respect. I'm serious about that. You should learn how to address people. Had it been the case that either Professor Dugard or myself addressed you in a disrespectful manner, we would deserve it in kind. But you're a law school, you're young people, you don't refer to us as you guys. That's a personal point, and I hope you'll allow me. Now, on the question of Ahmadinejad, I don't particularly like the statements he makes, but they're quite stupid, in fact. And I'm not going to support them, I don't pretend to. I thought his claims that he made before the United Nations that a handful of Zionists control the economic and political centers of the world, I thought it was a stupid and ignorant statement. And I was rather glad that Sheikh Nasrallah, when he gave his speech after Ahmadinejad, made it clear that it was not Israel but the United States that was behind most of the problems and troubles in the world. However, having said that, and not making any qualifications or reservations about President Ahmadinejad's statements, let's be clear. He made, I consider them deplorable, but he made these elliptical, purposely ambiguous statements. Now, let's compare his statement with the statement which was made last week by the Israeli general in the Northern Command. He said they called it in Israel the Dahil concept, namely that in the next war, Israel is going to turn all of Lebanon into what it did in Dahiyah. Now, for better or for worse, I was in Dahiyah a few months ago. Israel turned Dahiyah into a moonscape. It destroyed everything. Now, that was not an elliptical statement. That was not an ambiguous statement. That was an outright criminal statement by a senior official in the Israeli government. And my question is, why is it that when Israelis make statements like, we're going to inflict a Holocaust on Gaza, or we're going to turn all of Lebanon into Dahiya, those comments never register anything in the United States. But when Ahmadinejad makes admittedly stupid and deplorable statements, but nonetheless ambiguous ones, they're repeated over and over and over again, and we're told he's a new Hitler. If he's a new Hitler, what does it make of the person who said, we're going to inflict a Holocaust on Gaza? And what does it make of the general who said, we're going to turn all of Lebanon into Dahiya?
This question is directed towards Professor Engelstein, and it's regarding the right of return. I was wondering, regarding the right of return, the 700,000 or approximately 750,000 refugees that had fled or been forced to leave in 1948, that number having now ballooned to over 4 million. The advocacy for the right of return to me seems to be as unfeasible and absurd as, for example, demanding that Germany allow all survivors of the Holocaust and their descendants to return to Germany, Poland, etc., as well as demanding that all those who fled from Arab states in 1948, all Jews who were expelled from Arab states in 1948, and their descendants to return back to those countries. That seems to me to be an unfeasible thing to require of a country, and I was wondering what your comment on that is, speaking as someone who has influenced the Holocaust in the context of the refugee problem in Israel.
Well, I guess as a preliminary point, for obvious reasons, the analogy is weak, because there wouldn't be many German Jews to return. That's just an obviously weak analogy, but the point still stands. My own view on the topic, and I guess what we have to do is first of all separate my own view from what was the topic of this evening, namely what's the opinion of the legal community on these subjects. I don't pretend to command any kind of moral stature that my opinion should count for anything in this evening's discussion. If you were talking to a Nelson Mandela or a Gandhi or, as Professor Dugard mentioned, a Bishop Tutu, yes, they command moral authority, rightfully so, and therefore you look to them for their opinion. But there's no reason why, and frankly I would urge you not to look to me for my moral opinion on these topics. I was giving you the rendering of what the record shows. And the record is clear that the entire international community and the main human rights organizations state that under international law, the Palestinians have that right. The Palestinians and their descendants will maintain genuine links with the land. They have the right to return. Now that's the right. But then we have the question of its implementation. And you say that you consider it to be, the checklist term you use, you say it's not feasible, or infeasible, or unfeasible. It's not feasible. I'm not going to enter into that discussion because I have to be sensitive to other people when it comes to their rights. Nobody has the right to tell other people what to do with their rights. Our obligation as human beings is to support people's right to see their rights realized. At worst, you can, I suppose, to use a crude way of saying it, you can shut up. You can choose not to say anything. But I don't think anyone has the moral authority to tell other people that they should renounce their rights. Those are their rights. Our responsibility as moral actors, at minimum, is to uphold their right to their rights. Well, having said that, it still doesn't answer the question of whether I consider it feasible. And my answer to you would be simply this. If you think it's not feasible, and you're a moral individual and you recognize that you have no moral authority to tell other people how to exercise their rights, then your only choice, it seems to me, is to put forth an alternative such that they choose on their own not to exercise that particular right. You have to present the other side with an offer, and they on their own decide, hey, between exercising my right and the offer you're making, you know what, I'll take the offer. That's not so obscure. Everybody in this room has had experience with that. I had that experience on a very modest level at my last university. No, I'm not being facetious, I'm being serious. I was denied tenure. It was the opinion of most people, including my own very excellent lawyer, that if I pursued the matter in court, I would win. That I had, and I'm not trying to make light of the Palestinians, but I had a right to return to the pool. But my lawyer said to me, do you really want to go through 6 or 8 years of litigation, which is how long it would take with a 10-year case? I said, not really. There are better things I would want to do with my life than fight it out in court. So then she said, okay, then look for a settlement. And in the end, I gave up my right of return in exchange for a settlement. Now, that doesn't mean I am renouncing my right. No, I think I had a right to return. And I would have been extremely upset at anyone who told me, you know, Norman, that's not feasible after what the fall went through. And you know that's a joke. No. What people have a responsibility to do is, as I learned earlier, what Professor Dugard did. He sat down, he wrote a long letter to the pool saying why I had the right to return. And then it's up to me in the end to decide whether to exercise the right or choose a settlement. And if you really believe, and I'm not going to argue one way or another, but if you really believe that the right is not feasible, then your obligation is to speak to those Israelis who have to recognize that right and tell them, make a reasonable offer in exchange, and let's see what the Palestinians say.
I'm going to take two more questions and then wrap up the discussion.
Professor Dugard touched on the issue of security very briefly, and Mr. Finkelstein mentioned the well-known self-defense argument. I'm interested to hear your take on these issues of security and self-defense of the state of Israel.
What was security and self-defense of Israel?
I didn't want to take your time with statements about myself. I was born and raised in Iran, and I'm very familiar with anti-Israeli sentiments, from Ahmadinejad type of it to wipe out the Israel off the map, and to a more moderate one like yours. So I'm interested to know about your take on the issue of security and self-defense of the state of Israel to have a more balanced understanding of the whole issue. And the question is directed to what Professor Dugard.
The right of self-defense and security for Israel.
Well, obviously, Israel has a right to defend itself and to safeguard its own security. The question I raised this evening was whether Israel has the right to build a wall in Palestinian territory in order to safeguard its own security. And what I said was that Israel had a right to build a wall to protect itself along the Green Line, the recognized border between Israel and the occupied Palestinian territory. And that is essentially what the International Court of Justice ruled as well. obviously Israel does have a right to protect itself. It also has that right in respect of the Iraqis that occupied the Israeli territory from Gaza. But I would just like to issue a note of warning, and that relates to the use of the term terrorism by Israel. I grew up in apartheid South Africa, where white governments repeatedly won elections on the security issue. All one had to do to convince the white electorate to retain the apartheid government was to suggest that the security of the white community was involved, and that everyone who opposed apartheid was a terrorist. And the word terrorism was bandied about very freely. Now, unfortunately, I see that happening in Israel as well. Clearly, there are acts of terrorism that are committed, and here I refer to suicide bombing. But I think one has to accept that Israel does use the security card to sway the international community that it should be forgiven for all its transgressions. And I think one has to bear in mind that terrorism is a relative concept. One man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. One must, of course, remember that two Israeli distinguished prime ministers, Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir, were, by all accounts, terrorists, but they later became prime ministers. So I think one has to accept that these concepts are relevant. One shouldn't overdo the security, one shouldn't overplay the security card in the settlement of the dispute.
I'll address this to Professor Bernstein. You stated at the beginning of your talk that you felt that the standard of international law was really the only standard left these days to judge the situation by. And yet, Professor Pugard went through a litany of resolutions and international court decisions that, by his own description, have been largely ignored, and in fact, the situation has grown worse and worse. It seems to me that the international law in this sense is just as rhetorical as the kind of rhetoric that you were dismissing as useless in calling Zionism Zionism, the way you would call Jim Crow, or apartheid. So a label that's given to a colonial theology, and it seems that as such it's just as legitimate as the kind of analysis that you're doing in international law.
Well, I'll tell you just on a personal note, I studied African American history in undergrad. It wasn't my major, but it was my minor. And I never for the life of me understood what the expression Jim Crow meant. It was a case of people using a phrase rather than a content. And I'm not saying that I disagree with the content of the idea. I'm simply saying you want to communicate with people. Is it useful to say Zionist subversion, Zionist pig, or is it as useful as the previous generation used the expression fascist pig? Does it really get you very far in trying to do what purportedly you want to do, namely enlightening people so they can act? Now, the language of international law and human rights happens to be, for most people, fairly accessible because it's based on ordinary moral intuitions, at least in the current world. Torture is wrong. Collective punishment is wrong. Blowing up people's houses as a form of punishment is wrong. Taking hostages is wrong. That's the language of international law, it's the language of human rights, and it's the language which virtually everybody can without being tutored or being made privy to the secrets of your arcane language can understand. And so I'm just making an argument about intelligibility. I'm not arguing about the question of whether the phrase is accurate or not. As to the statement that these international laws and resolutions, they're routinely ignored, dismissed, sidelined, marginalized. Yes, it's all true. But you see, that's our job. The expression, God helps those who help themselves. And here I think the experience of the Zionist movement is a very useful one. Because the Zionists were very organized, very disciplined, very committed, indeed, one has to say, impressively so. And so they take a few words from this obscure foreign minister named Arthur Balfour, and they make sure every single person in the world knows those words by Arthur Balfour. Then they take this 1947 General Assembly resolution, the partition resolution, and they make sure everybody knows that the United Nations General Assembly sanctioned the creation of a Jewish state in Palestine. That's because they were hardworking, that's because they were disciplined, and that's because they were committed. And that's our job. Our job is to take the words of the International Court of Justice, to take those UN General Assembly resolutions, and tell people, hey, this is not a complicated conflict. This is not a controversial conflict. This isn't a conflict that requires the equivalent of the knowledge of rocket science to penetrate its mysteries. It's fairly straightforward. The principles for settling it are well known and uncontroversial, and the only obstacle is the United States and Israel. That's what we need to tell people. But we can't expect anyone to do the work for us. God helps those who help themselves.
The last question from here, and then we'll finish.
So mine's really simple, I think, but you were talking about, I think Professor Dugard, that there was 14 people and the one judge in regards to the advisory opinion didn't oppose it but had declared. You had stated that he agreed with the vast majority of everyone else, and I was just curious, because it was mentioned what he said he disagreed with, and thus the justification for his declaring.
Well, I don't think it's entirely accurate to say he agreed with the vast majority.
Okay.
He said that I agree with many of the points in the majority opinion. He then went on to say that he disagreed, number one, on the question of whether it was clear why Israel was building the wall. His view was that not sufficient amount of factual material had been brought forth for one reason being Israel refused to participate, for the court to reach a definitive judgment. He also said that he did not believe that you should use the standard of one judgment for the whole wall, but you should evaluate it on a segment-by-segment basis, which was the position which was eventually taken by the Israel High Court. But as I said, on A, and one may say the crucial question, on the question of the settlements, he was clear and unambiguous that they were illegal under international law.
Please join me in thanking both four speakers. Supporting the students and their efforts, students for justice in Palestine, for those who came late and asked for donations from the organizers to open the way.